I feel the Holy Spirit in this room. We're deeply grateful to our music worship leaders. They give themselves, Mike Seawright, Noel Anderson, Sarah and Stephanie Snyder, Doug Kelly, Paul Fandel, and Rick Latta, thank you for leading us in worship. Two years ago, my little granddaughter, Belle, playing games until I was exhausted, I sat in the living room chair and I said, I can't anymore, Belle. And she came up between my knees, took my cheeks in her hand, said, Appa, it will be hard, but it will be fun. And this morning, we're going through Mark's Gospel and Luke's Gospel. It will be hard, but I hope it will be fun and that we will really get something. One question I had from last night, because this leadership teaching is so deep and profound, libraries are so much simpler than being pastors. I don't know how you do it. And this question I wanted to ask Todd. He raised the point. He said, should we have taken a 10% cut in our salary and kept the six staff and the six missionaries? And I thought, yes. Wouldn't it have been, aren't we to put persons ahead of principles? And wouldn't it have been a nice sign if the whole staff had taken a 10% cut and they'd kept the six and the six? But Todd will answer that, I know, well tonight. But that was a question I had last night that these things are deep. I remember the one single thing I remember most about preaching class was when George Buttrick, who was then the outstanding preacher in the denomination, came down from Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church and spoke in the homiletics class. And he said during the week he spends 2 or 3 days visiting people in downtown New York and their homes when he can. And he said, the reason I do this is spend so much time in visitation, thank you, Tom, is that it says in John 10:5, the flock will not listen to the voice of strangers. That really impressed me, that this great preacher spent so much time taking people seriously and visiting them. I wouldn't have thought that a preacher did that, and that impressed me with putting people high. When my stepmother visited our First Presbyterian Church, Hollywood, Louis Evans called her on Sunday after, because they signed their name and phone, on Sunday afternoon he called her and talked to her personally. Apparently he did that with visitors because they signed their names. I owe my being a Christian to Joe Kinoshita, who visited me, knocked on my front door. What happened was I had been invited to the college department of the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood, and Miss Mears had a visitation program. She had all kinds of different things that were so thoughtful. And people, everybody who visited and put their address, you were personally visited by a person that week. And Joe Kinoshita came, I invited him, and he talked to me, and he said, we have a New Year's conference coming up at Forest Home. I was a freshman in the middle of my year at Occidental. He said, would you like to come? And I said, yes, I would. And I came, I heard the message there, and I accepted Christ. And if Joe Kinoshita hadn't visited me, I don't know what would have happened. I'm so grateful for Christian leaders like you who take persons seriously and one-on-one. Today, this first hour, we're doing Mark's Gospel. In the book of Revelation 4, 6 to 10, especially verse 7, it talks about the four living creatures. And it's taken from Ezekiel chapter 1. And one is like the face of a human. One had the face of a lion. One had the face of an oxen. And one had the face of an eagle. And the church, from the very beginning, has believed that the one with the face of the human was Mark, because he's our earliest gospel, and Jesus is so human in Mark. It's all messed up. He's got an ethical teaching here, then a miracle. And Matthew put all the main ethical teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, all the main miracles in chapters 8 and 9. Matthew's like your roommate who everything is in place. And Mark's the one who's got, the room is chaos. And lots of spitting in Mark, and a lot of miracles with spit. Not one drop of spit in all of Matthew. He is so tidy and neat. And Everything is, but Mark is so human, and we're going to look at that even in his opening and his very final verse. But the way I like to picture it is, Jesus is so multifaceted that Mark sort of takes a picture from down here and gets the humanity of Jesus. Matthew has, like Rembrandt's the Apostle Paul, has the profile of his, you see his nerves in his head and his brain, because he's the teaching gospel, the moral gospel. Luke is the social gospel, Good Samaritan, and all those great stories. We'll be looking at those. At his feet in the book of Acts is two volumes, and he took a picture of Jesus like this, the social gospel. John flew up like an eagle and wanted to take a picture from above because Jesus Christ is God with us. And from these four different angles, we get to see Jesus Christ. His humanity, Luke was the ox, as I said, and the four great those beasts are very much like these four gospels. The Gospel of Mark begins with the Arche tu Evangeliu, Jesu Christu Theou Huihu, Son of God. The Arche, we get Archbishop, Archdiocese, the lead, the beginning of the wonderful news. You means good. Eucharist, by the way, means good grace. Charis is a Greek word for grace. You is good. Euphoni, eulogy, Evangelion, the good news, the wonderful news of Jesu, Yeshua, Christos, Messiah, Son of God. And that's his opening sentence. I love the way Mark ends. As you know, in the NRSV, and I wish that was the Bible they had here in the, because it's our best. Mark's gospel ends at verse 8, as you know. They feel the last page was either lost it in transmission, or he died before he was able to finish. Because the very last verse in my NRSV properly, and in the Greek New Testament, verses 9 forward are in brackets because they were added in the second century to give it a happier ending. Because this is how it actually ends. All those, if you have your little outline there in front of you, you see those verbs. Says, and here's the very last, how the gospel, well, I'll tell the story. The women come into the tomb and they see a young man seated there inside. And he says, I know who you're looking for, Yeshu Nazareth, the man who was crucified. Uk esten hode egerthegar. This is fun. I call this the blessed 666. The sixth verse of Matthew, the sixth verse of Mark, and the sixth verse of Luke. By the way, in Luke, it's verse 5 in English, but it's six in the Greek translation. All three of the synoptic gospels have uk esten hode egerthegar. He's not here. He's been raised, you see. And I just think that's thrilling. And then he says, now, don't be afraid. Go tell his disciples and Peter. Mark has that. I love that. Because if he hadn't said that, I think when Peter would have said, I have fallen through the cracks, brother, you go if he wants to see you, but I know he doesn't want to see me. The very fact that the angel says, go tell his disciples, comma, and Peter. And they would say, you know, he said, and Peter. Did he mention my name? Yes. And then it says, so the woman took off from the tomb, and they ran for their life, efugon, we get fugitive from that, and they were filled with tromos. I hope they look just awful there. And they didn't tell anybody, they didn't tell anyone anything. They were so phobic, efobuntogar. Period, end of the gospel. What a way to end the gospel. But I find that so honest. Folks, resurrections are scary. And what I like to think, this is how Mark wanted to end it. He said, folks, they'll get over it. But it was very scary. And I just, even that humanity, that's the humanity of Mark's gospel, is that he would end it with phobia. And so I like Mark's gospel a lot. And I like its earthiness. And I thought I would begin at the end, because we did the resurrection last night. And again, this, my God, this is fun. There are three final words of Jesus, as you know, in Matthew's gospel. My God, why did you abandon me? And what are the other? Three in Matthew. there's only one, pardon me, in Matthew and Mark. It's the same one. It's this one. Luke has three. Father, the opening words of Luke's crucifixion. Father, as he's being nailed, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I find that deep. And then he speaks to the thief there, amen, today you will be with me in paradise. And then, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. That's Luke's three words. John, as we'll see tomorrow, are, I'm thirsty. And he says to his mother, look, your son, pointing with his head, I think, and the beloved disciple, look, your mother. And from that hour, he took her into his home. And then in Matthew and Mark, it's only one word, and it's the same one. It's the only gospel that has the same, and I love this. We didn't do it yesterday. We did, but my God, Eli, Eli, lema, for what reason? Por qué? Why? I love this, the punctuation of it even, that Matthew and Mark, his very last words on earth were a question. I find that, I mean, he really entered into it. He asked hard questions, and he asked our question. Wouldn't it have been more impressive to have Jesus' last word be, God is love, and then exclamation, and then die, or love one another, and then, I mean, I think if I'd written, I'd have an exclamation, I have some positive statement, but to end it with a question, I just love that fact that, and in two of our gospels, the double attestation, this is, they said, his last word, why did you abandon me? In the book of Genesis, I think it says, he does not stay forever with those who don't want him. And it's like he's saying, Father, I haven't abandoned you. Why did you abandon me? And I love this is a verb, and the verb is, English teachers know, as the major word in any sentence. I have been told that the single most hell-like experience in life is to be abandoned by someone you thought loved you. Both Luther and Calvin believe that this was Jesus' descent into hell when he said that sentence. And that he would honestly say that. In Gethsemane 2, remember his saying, if possible, take this cup from me. I am so grateful that when God became a human being, he became completely one with us and took on all our weaknesses and our questions and asked our deepest question. Why did you? In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's no male apostle present. In John's gospel, the beloved disciple is present. But he wrote the book, and I think he may have put that in. I'm not sure. But, yeah, okay, forgive me. But it's almost like he's saying, I can understand why they're not here, they're human, Father. But I have to honestly ask you, why did you? Why? And as all parents and grandparents know, you can Google what, when, where, how, I'm told, but try Googling why. That's the deepest human question. Jesus asked it for us. Calvin, in his commentary in this passage, has a wonderful point. He says, but notice whom he addresses. The God whom he honestly feels is not there, he still calls on. He says he takes hold of God with both hands of his heart. That's the idiom that Calvin uses. Though he doubts God's presence honestly, he still addresses. At first, this looks like the loss of faith, let's admit it. But this is, when you don't feel God is there and you still call on him, that's believing. And so I just treasure that sentence. I just feel, I love its honesty. I love its depth. Think of all that that means in terms of atonement. And 2 Corinthians 5:21, him who knew no sin, God made to be sin, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him, and that he would go do all of this for us. So Mark is the one who gave us that first, and so I put that there at the top. We did his expired yesterday when he gave up his spirit. There's this nice note in the NRSV, New Oxford Annotated Bible, to the is running off. This is typical of Martha. He's got a streaker in the cross, a little kid with no clothes on. It's ridiculous. And it says, the note, though, was helpful. It says, the young man's identity is not disclosed. Perhaps he was sleeping in the house where Jesus ate the Last Supper and rose hastily from bed to follow Jesus to Gethsemane. If the house was that of Mary, the mother of John Mark, where the disciples met at a later date, Acts 12, it is possible that the young man was the evangelist himself. You know, like Rembrandt would often paint himself in the corners, and other great artists would put themselves in, and maybe that's Mark. And that, I find that fun. In the 13th chapter, the verse that is most interesting to me at present, more mysterious, is when Jesus is talking. It's his sermon on the end of the world. And he says in the 30th verse, "This generation will not pass away until all this has happened." And that generation did pass away, and it didn't happen. Will you please tell me what that means? I just move over it very quickly and won't go on to the next point. I think we did this yesterday in Matthew, but about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son. And that he's agnostic. He said, the Father knows. When he became one of us, he emptied himself of all of his prerogatives in terms of knowing all things, and he didn't know himself, and I like that fact. We did the four questions yesterday in Matthew. By the way, 85% of Mark is in Matthew's gospel. 65% of Mark is in Luke's gospel. So in Mark, what's good about it is you have the earliest accounts. As you know from seminary, the two-source hypothesis is the reigning view of this. Mark gave Matthew and Luke their major stories. And then Q, the Quelle, in German, the source, it has the three temptations, which Mark doesn't have. It has the Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain, the Beatitudes, the Love Command. These are the two major sources of Matthew and Luke, are Mark and the Quelle. Matthew had some stories that are not in any of these, and Luke had some too. They're called M and L. But we come then to chapter 9. It said, "And came to this fig tree that had these leaves and so on, and he cursed it." But then he adds, typical Mark, "It was not the season for figs." And I think, again, that's a kind of a question. Poor fig tree. Wasn't even in season. But I think Mark says, well, you're supposed to still get the point. You're supposed to bear fruit, folks. I think no sign. Mark has, they came demanding, let's see a sign from heaven from you. He says, no signs will be given to you. And I think what Mark is saying is, in effect, what's wrong with me? I mean, isn't Jesus Christ himself and the way he treats people and the way he does things in his whole life, he's the sign. But Matthew and Luke felt, as you know, they both have, no sign will be given this generation except the sign of Jonah. Just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, Jesus continued, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Jesus is going to give one sign, his resurrection. And for us, that's plenty. And I'm very grateful for that teaching. Then in chapter 7, when only Mark has this too, he said, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him or a person, it's what comes out of that person that defiles. Thus, and here's this sentence, Mark, thus he declared all foods clean. He drops out about one-fifth of the Torah and all of its cleansing laws. One, all cleansed, and radical, how Jesus, he fulfilled the Old Testament, and a whole bunch of the stuff there, he said, it's no longer holds. The whole Sabbath teaching. I thought we were made for the Sabbath. We're made to keep the Ten Commandments. But remember, he said, human beings weren't made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for human beings. I mean, that's Jesus' humanism, his earthiness. And he said, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And his lack of being super rigorous and legalistic. And then when he said, thus he cleansed all foods, and how grateful we are for that simplicity. In the feeding of the 5,000, what's fun about that is, again, this is what makes Mark refreshing. The disciples come up, and Jesus has been talking with them for a day or two, and they come up, Lord. This is the only time I recall the disciples, except when Peter told Jesus he's not going to die. Remember, that was bad. But the disciples came up and said, Lord, it's quite late. And this is a desert place, as though Jesus didn't know the time of day or where he was. And that's almost what it sounds. We think it would be wise if you sent these people home so they could get some food. He said, oh, thank you very much for telling me what time it is and where we are. And said, I suggest you guys feed them. He said, oh, yeah, sure. We've got several $100,000. We can go nearby. Yeah, that's what they literally say there. They say how much money they've got. He says, well, go check. What do you have? He said, just a minute. We'll go see. And they found. And you can just see it's dripping with sarcasm. We've got 5 loaves here, Lord, and 2 little fish. Isn't that, I mean, like, this will be plenty for these 5,000. And Jesus takes them. You know what he does with them. And I think what that story is teaching us is to count to 8. 5 + 2 + Christ = 5,000. This is the new math. You've got a 5,000-sized problem in your church, and you don't have the means. You don't. Jesus Christ is alive and well on planet Earth, and he's real good at miracles. And we need to, I think that's what that story is trying to teach us. And so I love the feeding of the 5,000 story and Jesus' patience with his disciples. And then a couple of chapters later, when the feeding of the 4,000, they still don't get it. We're slow, aren't we, to learn. Dear Lord, thank you for your patience with us. Touching story where the woman with a hemorrhage for 12 years, it's two 12 years, the woman 12-year hemorrhage and a 12-year-old little girl. It's two 12-year-old stories there. And she said, I know if I can just touch the hem of his robe. And the people said, we're thronging him. And she touched it, and instantly she felt cured. And Jesus, it said, felt power go out of him. He said, wait a minute. And he said, who just touched me? And his disciples, again, typical Mark, so sarcastic. Lord, the whole word, this whole crowd's thronging. What do you mean, who touched me? And he said, someone touched me. And he looked for her, and she came forward and told him the whole story. He said, daughter, your sins are forgiven. Your faith made you whole. And I learned from that there's touching, you know, just kind of being around Jesus. And there's coming, Lord, you can help me. And may our touching of the Lord Jesus Christ be touching that comes with our major need and contact with him and faith that he can do something for us. I think that's what that story is trying to teach us. Chapter 4 is the parable of the soils, and I found it fascinating. The verb listen is used 14 times in 34 verses. In fact, it's the opening word, listen! Exclamation, that's his opening word. Akouete, listen! And he told the parable. And then I found it fun when he interprets the parable. In all three of the ones that land on the Rockies, they listened, aorist. They listened, and then see you later. And then the other ones, they listened, but the anxieties of this age and the desire for more, it says, choked the word, and they didn't get it. And then the third one, persecution and trouble, they listened. Said the one that landed in the fourth soil are listening. It's a present tense participle, ing word. The one that landed in the fourth soil are listening. And all of us know that the major reality in human relations is listening to partners. By the way, our major marital problem, and Kathy is working on me on this, is I need to learn to chat. Because, wives, is this a problem you have too, that if your husband would just talk with you a little bit more? I don't know, maybe no one else has this problem, but that's Kathy's main desire, is that I'll chat. So when she picks me up at Fuller, we go to the park, and we walk in the park, and I chat. Just about whatever happened that day, about earthy things, not about the Bible, but about... and... and listening. Isn't that the major gift we give to other persons, is listening to them and being there for them? And that will be highlighted in Luke's gospel in several ways, but I find it already in the parable of the soils and in Jesus' interpretation. Listen, and at the end, listen again, he says, let's listen to each other, and let's listen to him. That's what I get from that text. We've done that Rocky one. Jesus gave him that nickname, and I share in this group, very group, that I never had a nickname, and that's when you gave me the nickname Biff, and I'm so, so grateful. But these disciples, do we owe a lot to them, folks? if we didn't have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? What if Jesus Christ had come and done all the fabulous stuff he did and it never got written down? And these are classic. I mean, even Mark, with all his spit and mess, it is so earthy, so human, and so readable, and our little kids can get it and can teach it. I mean, I am so grateful for this. And a few years ago, there was a writer's strike in Hollywood, and you may remember what Jay Leno did. And I memorized the three sentences. It was in the LA Times, and then it was in the Time magazine. And when the writers were striking, their pickets and so on, it has a picture of Jay Leno right in the front row, and he said these three sentences. And when I read them, I thought of what Jesus could say about his disciples. He said, I've been working with these guys for 20 years. Without them, I'm not funny. I'm a dead man. I love that he said that about these guys. He says, I've been working with these guys for 20 years. Without them, I'm not funny. I'm a dead man. I think Jesus could have said, I've been working with these guys for 3 years. Without them, I'm not history. I'm a dead man. He would be a myth or a saga if he hadn't been written down. And these four Gospels, I think we owe so much to their accessibility and their earthiness and their honesty. My God, why? And being baptized with the sinners and all of the, I just think they're treasures and we have access to them. Are we not privileged? All right, I like that. Now, I mentioned yesterday, because it's in Matthew, people who are well don't need a doctor. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. And that was where I first remember saying to Kathy, there is gospel in the Gospels. That's very evangelical. By the way, did I ever tell you what happened, another thing that happened that first anniversary? Did I tell you the story of, I wonder. We lived near the Elbe, and we walked about a mile, and then we went about 100 steps to the castle, Sulberg Castle, for our first wedding anniversary, Hamburg, Germany. And we didn't drink alcohol because at Hollywood you just didn't do that. And it was, but all of the, we lived in Missions Academy, which was where the missionaries on furlough stayed, and we had room there with them. And they were wonderful Christians, and they drank beer all the time. And they told us, Americans said, water rusts your stomach. That's what they said. And it was fun. Afternoon, I said to Kathy, let's order wine, because it's not a sin. So I ordered a bottle for Kathy and a bottle for me. I had, you know, a Coca-Cola for you, a Coca-Cola for me. And so, and as we drank, she got more and more. When we finished the whole thing, we could barely make it down those 100 steps. I don't know how we got home, but here's history. 9 months later, Frederick Carlton Booth blew up. I rather like wine. Okay. Let's do, forgive me, Lord. Okay, let's turn to Luke's gospel. Because most of Mark, 85%, is in Matthew, and we got it covered. And I hope you have this little thing in pictures. And thoughtful Jim. Did I get his last name? Yeah, Jim Stockel did this for him. I'm very grateful. And him and Mike Escobar. Yeah, did I get it right? Mike Ortega. Yeah, thank you for all that you've done. And oh yeah, that's great. That's Luke with a looking glass there. The what do you call it, Mike? Magnifying glass. And that third verse really strikes me. His scholarship. It goes like this, you know that, how his little prologue. Since many have taken, these are the opening verses of Luke's gospel, since many have taken in hand to write an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled in our midst, just as they were handed down to us by those who were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. And now the great third verse. It seemed good to me also, having closely followed, para akalutheo, para, we get parallel, and that's that bottom thing, para, having closely, not just followed, but having closely followed, and then anothen, from the top down, that's the same word used in John 3, you must be born from the top down. Anothen is the word. And in the NRSV translate, you must be born from above. And so he studied everything from the top down closely. Pasen means everything. And then akribos on the left, carefully. The scholarship of Luke. And we capture that. It's the best Greek in the New Testament, as you know. And I just love the fact that he did everything from the top down, closely followed it. Accurately, everything. And those are the 24 chapters there. He put all these stories together. I think he may have even talking with Mary, because he's got those beautiful first two chapters on the Nativity. And I just love his carefulness there. He's Mark is so earthy, Luke is so careful, Matthew's so organized, John is so divine, really. And then I love the second chapter, the seventh verse. That's meant to be in, and I drew it better here, I think. Yeah, I should have drawn that, because he was born in a feed bin. I love that, verse 2. Said, and when she came time for her to give birth, this is chapter 2, verse 7, she gave birth to her firstborn son. That's interesting, by the way, that she had other children. She gave birth to her first, and she laid him in a feed, I'll translate this, in an animal feed bin, because there was no room for them in the inn. Couldn't God have made a reservation in the Bethlehem Hilton? I mean, but isn't this like God when he comes to planet Earth? He dies on a cross, he's in a feed bin because there wasn't any room. And just that verse just grabs me, that God, this is like God. He takes the low way. And my father used to say, if he'd look at my room and he'd say, were you born in the barn, son? And I wasn't a Christian, if I could have told him Jesus was. But I love the very fact of how he begins his life. There's a whole gospel in that. I love the fact, and I mentioned it yesterday briefly, that while Matthew has, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, Luke's is, blessed are the poor. Yours is the key. Blessed are those who are hungry now. You will be filled. Blessed are those who are heartbroken now. You will laugh. And then he has the four woes, which Matthew doesn't have here. He has them in the 23rd chapter. Woe to you who are well-to-do. You've had all the consolation you're ever going to have. And as you know, Luke is particularly is very hard on the whole money thing. And you will, blessed are you who are well fed now, and that applies to me and us. You're going to go hungry. Blessed are you who are happy now. You're going to wail. And blessed, and woe to you when all men speak well of you, when you're popular, when you're well-liked, when everything seems to go swimmingly. He said that's exactly how they talked about the false prophets who were before you. Boy, does that, should that not shake us up? Dear Lord, help me not to buy popularity at the price of loyalty to you. So I love the four social blessings and woes of Luke's gospel, of the great social gospel. Then in the seventh chapter, 747, I call it the Boeing verse. this is a fun story. Luke, only he has this, and only he has the publican and the Pharisee and the good Samaritan and the prodigal. I mean, he was collected so many great stories. And this one goes like this. One of the very serious, that's how I translate Pharisees, invited Jesus to his home for dinner. Jesus came in, took his place at the table. Then a woman who was a sinner in the city came in the back door, came and knelt down at his feet, and she was weeping and drying his, washing his feet with her tears and drying it with her hair, and she was kissing his feet and pouring oil on, And said the serious guy was over. He said, if this guy were a man of God, he'd know what kind of woman she is. And he was not impressed. And he said, Simon, could I say something? He said, yeah, go ahead. A creditor had two debtors. One owed him $500,000 and the other owed him $50. He forgave both of them. Which one do you think will love him more? He said, oh, I guess the one whom he forgave more. He said, you got it exactly right. Nice going. He said, see this woman? He said, I sure do. He said, I came into your house. You did not give me a kiss, a greeting. She hasn't stopped kissing my feet since the moment I came in. You gave me no water for my feet, which is what they did in there. You know, they washed their feet, one of the servants. But she hasn't stopped weeping on my feet. You gave me no kiss of greeting. She hasn't stopped kissing me. She, whose sins are many, has been forgiven, as you can see from the fact that she loves so much. And then here's this picky line. It says, the person who has been little forgiven loves little. And he turned to the woman, he said, your sins indeed have been forgiven. You can go. And I just love that story. That I don't recommend that women do this kind of a thing to their pastors or other, but it's not a... but is it not a great story about... And the source, the major source of love is a sense of forgiveness. Dear Lord, may we have a sense of having been deeply forgiven and loved. I need that. I think I have to earn it. For that reason, Heidelberg Catechism question 60 is my favorite text. And I bet I cite it once a month in my Sunday school class. Question, how art thou righteous before God? Answer, only by simple faith in Jesus Christ. That is, although I have grievously sinned against the Ten Commandments and have never really kept any of them perfectly, and although I am still inclined to evil in many ways, nevertheless, of mere grace, without any merit of my own whatsoever, God grants to me and credits to me the perfect righteousness, satisfaction, holiness of Jesus Christ himself, as if I had never, ever sinned, or had even been a sinner, and as if I had kept all those commandments which Christ kept for me, if only I will accept such a benefit with a believing heart. I would love to walk around just believing, Bruner, you're fine. When my little cat Pumpkin gets on my shoulder, brum, 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 makes me feel like God. I just feel, that the purring of a cat is just so, and I have the feeling that we ought to be purring in the love of God. I just want to realize, Bruner, you're fine, and stop trying to think you need to earn it. And I really think this would relax us, and we would be even more Christian if we believed in the credited righteousness of Paul's Romans teaches us. He grants and credits to me the perfect righteousness. I had a funny experience with a Pentecostal friend, Gideon Johannes. Johannes Gideon. And he's Ethiopian Christian, and he was in the front desk in the library, and he used to like to ask me questions. He called me Mr. Presbyterian. As I was going upstairs, he'd say, Mr. Presbyterian, what do you think about healing? I said, I'll check with the committee, and I'll get back to you, Gideon, later. And the last question he ever asked was this one on this end. He said, Bruner, Mr. Presbyterian, what's God going to say to you at Judgment Day? And I had just been doing Heidelberg. He's going to say, Bruner, you're terrific. Thanks a lot for trusting me. He looked at me like this. An egomaniac. But that's, isn't that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
And shouldn't we believe it?
Yeah.
All right. Good for you. Okay. Okay. I think, let's see. Yeah, I'll take 2 more minutes, then we'll have 10 minutes for questions. Jesus' priorities. Oh, okay. Yeah, I like the story. He only has it. He comes to the house of Martha, and Mary sat at his feet while Martha was all over the house, distracted by doing all kinds of things. And finally, she leans over. Lord, does it not matter to you that my sister here has left me to do all the work? Tell her to get up and help me. Martha, Martha, you are so busy and distracted by many things. She's chosen the major part, and it's not going to be taken away from her. What I love about that is the main thing with a guest is to listen to them and to talk to them. And we can be so busy doing things, and we're not just these. So, dear Lord, I love that Mary Martha story, and I think it's a good picture. By the way, Martha is the hero in the Raising of Lazarus story. Isn't that fun? We're going to do that tomorrow. Okay, his spirit promise. I think I'll do that when I do the Holy Spirit in Acts on Friday. Oh, yeah, the two guys who go up into the... Only Luke has this story, too. Two men went up into the temple to pray. The serious man stood by himself over like this, and he said, "Dear Lord, I thank you I'm not like the rest of the human race. Or a rip-off artist, an adulterer, a bad guy. But you've perhaps noticed I tithe everything. I fast twice a week. I thank you for me." That's I added that, but that's the sense of the And Jesus said, meanwhile, the collaborator would not even lift his eyes up into heaven. And it's the very back of the temple. And he beat his chest and he said, "Dear God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And Jesus said, "This man went home in a right relationship with God and not that man." Isn't that the gospel? Another. How is it possible, by the way, I've never asked this of a class before, to have both the sense that be merciful to me, a sinner, which I think is what we need, and the sense of reckoned righteousness at the same time. Do you follow? It's a little tricky and delicate. Okay. 3 minutes until 10 after. Okay. My favorite story in the whole, in fact, at Monte Vista Grove, where Larry Ballinger was our president, I'm so grateful for Larry and his cheerfulness. He's a minister, gospel. And what was I starting to say? Favorite. Monte Vista Grove Retirement Community, to give your little service when you die. And what verse do you want read? I want Luke 15:31 read. It's my single verse. And let me tell the story now. This may take 5 minutes, so we'll have 5 minutes at the end of this hour and 5 minutes at the beginning of the next hour for the questions, okay? Okay, here we go. I love the prodigal. Said, this is Luke 15. He said, many sinners and collaborating people were beginning to come to Jesus' meeting, standing at the back. And the serious and the Bible teachers grumbled and said, this guy welcomes immoral and bad people. And Jesus said, let me tell you a story. And then he has it's a singular. Let me tell you one story, but it's a parable. But it's got the lost sheep and the 99, and he goes after the one, and there's more joy, and it ends, you know, there's more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 who don't need it. And he says, and a woman lost a coin, and she swept and lit her lamp until she found it, and she called her neighbors, let's have a party, I found my coin. And then the parable of the prodigal father. Oh, I like this. Oxford Dictionary, it says, prodigal, one of the definitions is excessive. It says, she put a prodigal amount of whipped cream on my chocolate cake. It can mean over the top. And so the father is absolutely, verses 12, 20, and 28, there are 8 verses, are the 3 big ones. It says, a certain father had 2 sons. One day the younger of the 2 said, Father, would you please give me my family inheritance now? It's like, I can't wait till you die. And so the father, that's verse 12, first surprise. I would have said, I've seen the gleam in your eyes and the kind of TV shows you're watching. I'm not going to give you this money. But he's surprised. He gave them his family inheritance. And it says to the other boy, notice the plural too. They get right then and there. Not many days thereafter, the boy took absolutely everything he had. And he took off for a makran. It's the opposite of micro, close, near. Makran means far, distant. For a far country. And there he wasted. We use that verb. That guy got wasted. He says, wasted his life in a life without boundaries. And when he'd spent everything of his income, a huge famine hit that country, and the kids started to go under. But he got himself connected to one of the citizens of that country who sent him out into his field to feed pigs. To a Jew, this is absolute degradation. And he said the boy would gladly have filled his belly with the pods the pigs were eating. And nobody gave him a blessed thing. Then one day, when he came to himself, he said, wait a minute. How many of my father's hired hands are swimming in bread? And I'm his son, starving in this pig pen. I know what I'll do. I'll get up, I'll go back to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I don't deserve to be called your son. So the son got up, and he started back. And imagine he's back there coming. And it said, while he was still makran, I love that word, it's the same word for far. How did the father know if he's makran? Father knows his son, folks. So while he was still there, his father ran, and he ran, and he ran. And they say this was disgraceful in the Middle East to do this. You're supposed to wait till the boy shows it really means it, gives a full confession and does penance. But the father ran. Before even, he could just be coming back for more money. But he threw himself on his son, and he embraced him, and he kissed him much. I just love that. And the boy only gets two-thirds of his confession out. He says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I don't deserve to be called your son. Father breaks him off. He says, quick, get the best robe, reckoned righteousness, put it on him. Get the signet ring, which was a Visa card in those days, and clay, like, for this, that's the power of the Holy Spirit. And put sandals. I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes. Get sandals for him. You, kill the fatted calf, and let's have a party. This, my son, was dead. He's alive again. He was lost. He's been found. That the father would do that to that son just shows me, if Jesus Christ knows what God the Father is like, and if the Father's like that, we're in luck. Oh, is God like that? I think that's a great story. But I love that the next eight, it says, meanwhile, back at the ranch, the older brother was out in the field. He's working, not fooling around. And he starts back to the house, and he hears the sounds of music and dancing. You've heard the definition of a Puritan. A Puritan is a person with a haunting fear that someone, somewhere, is happy. And that's not fair to the Puritans. But he hears the sound. Says, here's the sounds of music and dancing. And he called one of them. What's going on in there? He says, good news. Your brother's home, and your father's killed a fatted calf because he's safe and sound. Aren't you thrilled? And it said the boy was absolutely furious. I hope I've got it. See, that's, where is he? See the steam going up from his, okay. And this verse, listen to this next verse. The father came out and pled with his son. The love of God. I would have said, stay out there. We're having a better party without you. I mean, that's what I would have said. Lord have mercy. And he pled with his son and said to please come in. And it says, the son said, look at it. It says, look, you do. He says, look, like the father's blind. Look, I have slaved for you. What a view of Christian life. I have slaved for you all these years. I have never broken one single command. And I want to say, what about the command of love? But I've never broken one of your commands. And yet, you've never even killed a fatted calf for this son who's wasted our income. Yet you've never even given me a shriveled up old goat so I can have a party with my friends. Here's 1531, my memorial service. Because I feel like this self-righteous brother. I've never been in a far country. I've just been reading my Bible. And even to problematic people like me, who's his son, he says technon, which is the most tender Greek word. It's not paideon, it's technon, my dear child. You are always with me, and everything I have is yours. Oh, do you love me like that, Lord? You are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But it was right for us to have this party, because this your son, your brother, pardon me, the boy had said, this is your son. You know, whenever one of our boys is bad, I said, you know what your son did to Kathy? We always call him by other, but isn't that interesting? He says, this your brother was dead. He's alive again. He was lost. He's been found, period. We don't know. How is this story going to end? Will the elder brother come to the party? And I just, that text teaches me as much about the love of God as the cross almost. I'm very grateful for it. We have 5 minutes for questions. Anything? Yes, Noel.
In Mark's gospel, he's so deliberate about details, and I'm just wondering if there's anything to it that when they go in that says he was sitting on the right side, if there's any significance in that, because I don't think Mark throws away details.
Interesting. Noel asks the question, is there anything about when they went in that's that young man in the tomb was sitting on the right side? Why does he say that and not on the left? And a lot of questions like that. In Mark, it's a young man in the tomb. In Matthew, as we saw yesterday, it's an angel comes down from heaven, causes an earthquake, and sits on the rock. In Luke, it's two young men. And in John, it's two angels. As I mentioned, it gets better and better as the chronology goes along. I haven't the foggiest. How's that? Is that helpful? Yes, yes. Yeah. Why it says on the right side. Yes.
Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, Sermon on the Plain in Luke.
Yes.
Is this Jesus' stump sermon that he gives as he moves around, or are the gospel writers being creative and manipulating the text for their purposes?
Tim Fearer asks the interesting question. Sermon on the Plain in Luke, Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. Did Jesus have a stump speech that he gave at every different place, and this is just... Yeah, I don't have anything against the suggestion that he gave the same messages in several places. And in certain situations, he made it real social, as it is in Luke, blessed are the poor. And in certain situations, he made it spiritual, like Matthew. They do believe that comes from the Kabbalah, because both of them have it. It ends with the love command, starts with the Beatitudes. It's almost the same exact structure, but Luke shapes it in a social direction, Matthew in a moral direction. Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes. Steve.
Yeah. We were talking about
Craig.
The cry of the forsaken, Jesus from the cross, why have you abandoned me, Father?
Yes.
And then we just were contemplating the Father's love for his son.
Yes.
And
yes.
One of the questions that was given to me by a mother on Good Friday was how could the father turn his back on his son?
Yes.
If I can't imagine doing that with my own children.
No.
And this is a theological question.
Yes.
It's not an exegetical question, but I don't know if you're familiar with the book The Shack, but one of the critical points that he made in that book was that the father didn't turn his back on his son, but he experienced that abandonment. But he was with the son.
I like that.
That was the point. The father was with the son on the cross. And what do you think about that? Can you defend that?
Yes, what about that? Steve and Bill Craig would not do this to their own children. How come the father did it? Boy, there's a lot of debate about that. The feminists, radical, have said this is divine child abuse, and they don't like the idea that that he did this. This is how I presently see the doctrine of the atonement, the four-pointed cross. He satisfied God's justice and wrath, and I do think Anselmian Latin theory is still viable. I think that with what Steve just said, that God suffered as much as his son in that, and I love the line in the hymn, "And can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me?" And I have no problem at all in their consulting together, and he would be willing to do this and become that. But I do think that the atonement at one moment, that God really did want his, he didn't just wink at saying, no big deal. No, it's a big deal. It needs to be punished. And so he shows me how seriously God takes sin, that his own son would come down and take it. And I have no problem with it being all the sacrifices in the book of Leviticus are offered to God. So although this a lot of modern atonement doctrine, they don't like this satisfaction theory, I like it very much. I love that phrase in Stuart Townsend's song, and I was talking with Mike about that earlier on. Where on that cross where Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. And to me, it just shows how seriously he takes sin, and his son, how seriously he takes it too. So I love, frankly, that's my favorite. Love of God, the love of God, this is the more, the liberal theology likes this better, but I think it's true that God loved us so much that he gave, and it shows the love for the world. He banished the devil, Christus Victor. I like the knocked the evil one out. And he inserted truth into history in his cross. I think the cross is multifaceted. And I have no problem whatsoever with it being aimed Godward. That's where I am at the present moment. Yes, last one.
The engineer in my church who teaches the Bible class, he didn't like when I talked about the Father forsaking the Son and the Son taking the forsakenness
yes.
himself. He said because if the Father could do that to his Son, he could do that to any one of us at any time.
Oh boy.
I don't know that that necessarily follows, but that's what it meant for that engineer in my church was, so he seemed to push back in that same way, like he couldn't have really, but it seems weird if it's a fake abandonment versus an actual abandonment. It seems kind of weird too.
Thank you very much, Jim Rauch. I hope you heard that question, but an engineer in his congregation found this very hard. If he would abandon his son, why could he not do the same? And what I learned from this and from sensitive people is, Bruner, you better be careful. You better study this doctrine. I have the feeling this is almost a major doctrine we should study, is the Christ's work on the cross, because it can seem capricious. And not it's not like the father of the prodigal father here we saw in Luke. But so I thank you for being honest about that. I think our time is up, so we'll start the first 5 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes of the second hour with questions so that we can have plenty of time for that. Thank you.